I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CauseMetics. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hi, I'm Chanti.
And I'm Lynx. And you're listening to Muses.
Enjoy the show.
Hey there. So the interview you're about to hear is with Roxana Shirazi. And I'm really excited about this one. And Lynx is really excited, too.
Absolutely.
We covered her book back in episode 19. And we're on episode 102 now.
Yeah.
So it's always a nice goal realized, you know, dream come true when you get to interview somebody whose work that you admire. And then you get to chat with them about their work and their past and their upcoming stuff. And I had met Roxana a couple summers ago back in the UK, and so it was nice to chat with her.
Yeah, it was great. Roxana is the author of The Last Living Slut, Born in Iran, Bred Backstage, and she also has an upcoming book called Dead Iranian Girl. She's also a teacher and journalist. She discusses such issues as sexual politics and gender theory.
Yeah, and her journalism covers interviews with the KKK. We talk a little bit about...
Yeah, she certainly has a fascinating life story, and she's amazing. It was really an interesting discussion. We talk about, you know, backstage debauchery, what it was like then versus now, some of the misogyny in the rock and roll world, things she's experienced.
Yeah, it being a boys club, and we just talk about equality and then the roles of men and women and the music industry.
Yeah,
we talk about Motley Crue. We talk about their book, The Dirt, which is kind of being made into a film. It should be kind of coming out any time now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was just a fantastic conversation, and I'm excited to put this one up and hear what everyone has to say.
Yeah, enjoy.
Absolutely. Let's go.
Amazing. Well, we kind of like to start back at people's childhoods, and you certainly have a fascinating childhood. Your early childhood was spent in Iran during the revolution. Curious, what was that like? And I read that you had some politically activist parents.
Yeah. It was a very political childhood. I grew up during the before and after the revolution, and my family were full on intense political activists. My uncles, my aunts, my mum's cousins. So I grew up in a household with I was surrounded by books, political books, and people coming in and out, political prisoners, people going on demonstrations. I was right in the thick of it.
So you were 10 when you moved to England with your grandma?
Yes, I was sent here under the guise of it's a vacation.
Oh. So
I wasn't aware that I was going to be sent here permanently. So my grandmother accompanied me, and she unfortunately died a couple of months later. And I was it was a very traumatic year for me, being a child alone in England without speaking English, without having a family, being hungry all the time, and being racially bullied. And it was like one of the worst years of my life. So it was a shock to my system to come from a very warm, loving community of cousins, friends, a great school in Tehran, fantastic life, you know, we had money, everything, to being completely and utterly alone and racially bullied every day.
Wow. Did you know much about England before you arrived there? Like, I assume the sort of expectation versus reality of the situation was, like, such a shock for you.
As a child, I was 10, you sort of think, you don't think about, maybe I thought it was like Mary Poppins, like, yeah. Pretty, cute, lovely colored, like a child's imagination about another country in a very Disney-fied way. So it was just like, yeah, it's fun, get on an airplane, go to another country. You don't think about the repercussions of that, like, you just think you're going there and it's going to be fun. But yes, it was a huge shock to my system, absolutely, yeah.
Were you still in contact with your parents?
I used to write letters. So I used to write letters to my mother, and she's collected them all, and she shows me now. And they're so funny, because, like, the letters talk about, like, really cool stuff, like, I'm seeing these guys with Mohicans on their head, and they're called punk rockers, mm-hmm. and they have tattoos, and they're so cool and different, and I want to be like that. I'm like, I was 10 from Iran, and I was, like, writing this to my mother. It's really funny. And then I'm writing about really political stuff too, like the social classes. Which 10-year-olds write about social class? It's really funny. And I used to write to my mother all the time, but I was just a lost kid in an alien land. I was just lost completely. I was in shell shock, actually. Yeah.
I love the way that you wrote about it, and the way that you wrote about your childhood, and I felt that I was transported, and I was there with you just based on the way that you wrote. And so I was so fascinated by your book that, you know, Lynx and I have been doing this podcast now for 2 years, more than 2 years, and your book was one of the first episodes that I ever, it's one of the earlier ones where I really got to explore those things. So besides writing the letters to your mom, did you grow up writing? Was literature always an important part of your life?
Yeah, so as soon as I could read and write, when I was about 5, I started reading lots. And I was given political books by my uncles. I was 5 and 6. And I never had a father, but my mother and my uncles, they were all quite into art and literature and theater. So they were very creative, so they were giving me books on all sorts of things as a child. So I was quite a well-read child and understood the world that we lived in. And I read lots of books, and I started writing, I started writing properly when I was alone in England and had nothing, I didn't know how to express myself. So I started writing about everything. So from that age, really.
Yeah, it's so important in those situations to find an outlet, you know, if you don't have a whole bunch of friends to speak to, at least you're getting that out and you're, you know,
Yeah.
It's therapeutic.
Oh, completely, because I think if you have suddenly been thrown into the wilderness from a country like Iran, which has got very rich culture, family culture, the food, the colours, the nature, and you're suddenly thrown into the ghetto part of England, which was a part in Manchester, which is devoid of colour, it's very grey, it's kind of a lot of poverty, and you're quite a well-read child, and you're quite a social child, but you've got nothing, you no one to talk to, then you take to writing to kind of have an outlet, like you said, mm-hmm. to sort of just really bring out, you know, spew out your feelings, really.
So who are your literary idols?
Now? Or
Now and then.
I love Sylvia Plath. I love her poetry. It's very me. I know it's very depressing, but it's just me. I love a writer called Michael Cunningham, who wrote The Hours, which was made into a film with Nicole Kidman and Meryl Streep, The Hours, and that's about Virginia Woolf. I love Virginia Woolf as well. I love a writer called John Niven, who wrote a book called Kill Your Friend, and it's about the the music industry in the 90s, you know, with the whole Britpop thing. Mm-hmm. And he was an A&R guy in the 90s. He used to scout for bands like Coldplay. Then he turned down Coldplay and Muse. And he wrote a book called Kill Your Friend. It's black comedy. It's a bit like American Psycho. And it's about their, you know, his life in the music industry. And it's hilarious. It's very dark. It's very un-PC, and it's crazy, and I really like the way he writes. It's very biting.
That sounds great. Actually, I really do like the book American Psycho, and I'm a big Bret Easton Ellis fan. And didn't you and I go, were we at the Jack the Ripper Museum when we...
Yes, we were, yes.
So we kind of like that kind of, we have that in common, that we like a good kind of dark tale.
Absolutely. I love human things. I don't like people who censor or sort of shy away from, whether it's grotesque or, you know, it's kind of raw and crude. I like people who are honest when they write.
And I think that's what got me so much with your book, and how it was not like anything I had ever read before, and then just getting to know you and following you on social media, and just how honest, how open, you speak freely, you say what's on your mind, and it's almost rare, I think, to find in some people. So that's why I think I was just drawn to your story and who you are and how you speak about, like, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah, so I believe in humanity. I think that there's always has been different rules for men and women. So throughout history, men like Henry Miller, Charles Bukowski, Hunter S. Thompson are applauded and idolized for writing in very raw and human terms about their sexuality, their class, their working class background, their poverty, and they are, because it's a masculine, you know, masculine constructed, society constructs masculine as being able to be humanity in its full capacity, whereas women have to be selective in how they express those things. So, because femininity is constructed as, you know, pretty, soft, satin sheets, four-poster bed. So when women have written about sexuality, it's, if you look at Aeneas Nin, it's all within the context of satin sheets, princes, four-poster beds, wealth. There is nothing about STDs, nothing about poverty, hunger. It's got to be pretty. It's got to be cutesy. And even when women have, in the 60s and 70s, with second wave feminism, wrote about sexuality, it was like, it was bound within things like child abuse or violence. So there always has to be a reason for female sexuality.
Wow.
It's either you've been sexually abused or something traumatic happened to you. Or like it's within the bounds of, like, you know, wealth, like Sex and the City. You know, there's sex, but only if it's upper class wealthy women spent wearing designer labels. you know, that women have not been able to write like men do about class, you know, about raw, in a raw way. So why? Why is that another one rule for men? And why? I don't understand that. It's just illogical. So just be yourself as a human being. That's it.
So when did sexual politics and gender theory become an important part of your life, a fascination for you, something you really wanted to, you know, discuss?
There was never a point where I thought I'm going to discuss this. It was just through lived experience as I'm getting older and wiser. It was just experiencing life and understanding that there are always different rules for men and different for women. And I was just like, it's very strange. It's bizarre to me. Because we don't live in Saudi Arabia. We live in the Western world. So why are women are demonized for what, and men are heroes or idolized for doing the same thing? So it wasn't like at one point I thought, right, I'm going to get into gender. It was just like living life and witnessing things and understanding society's reactions and reflections on different gender issues, that I began to kind of question things and just talk about it.
You discuss in your book, you know, leaving home as a teenager, and one of your first jobs was working as a dancer. Was that an empowering experience for you?
I don't think it's ever empowering to run away from home due to your stepfather beating you and having to do something. I mean, I was always very sexual as a child. I was very sexual as a teenage girl. I never had sex with boys until I was 24. But I was very sexual. I had a big sexual appetite. And I was quite an extrovert. I was always performing since I was like 5, singing and dancing and acting. So the first logical thought for me was to dance to earn money when I ran away. And I think it was like, I don't mind being on a stage. I like it. I'm quite extroverted. And I don't mind stripping. It wasn't, I don't think it's, I didn't think of it in that way, empowering or not empowering. It was just like, oh, I like this activity. I just want to do it because I like it. It's fun. So I did it. And yeah, I mean, it was, I'm quite an extrovert. Some people are not. I'm not saying, you know, stripping or any kind of thing is applicable to everybody. Every human is different. It just happens that I'm quite extroverted and I enjoy certain things that some girls might not. So, you know, you can't just put the same kind of model of empowerment for every woman. Every woman's empowered by different things.
Support for today's show comes from Lola. Lola is a female-founded company offering a line of organic cotton tampons, pads, liners, and all-natural cleansing wipes. Unlike other major brands, Lola products are 100% natural and easy to feel good about. No BS, mystery fibers, or doubts about what's going in your body. Plus, Lola products come in a simple, customizable subscription. Lola will deliver exactly what you need, exactly when you need it. Did you know the FDA doesn't require brands to disclose a comprehensive list of ingredients in their feminine care products? So most don't. I love that Lola offers complete transparency about the ingredients found in their tampons, pads, liners, and wipes. Major brands use a mix of synthetic ingredients in their products, including rayon and polyester. Their feminine care products may also be treated with harsh chemical cleansing agents, fragrances, and dyes. Lola products are 100% organic cotton with no added chemical, fragrances, synthetics, or dyes. That is super important to me. Lola also helps make your month a little bit easier. Their subscriptions are fully customizable, so you can choose a mix of products, mix of absorbency, number of boxes, and frequency of deliveries. Lola subscriptions are super flexible. You can change, skip, or cancel your subscription at any time. Something else that I absolutely love about the company is that with every purchase, Lola donates feminine care products to homeless shelters across the U.S., so a purchase for yourself goes to help others as well. For 40% off all subscriptions, visit mylola.com and enter the promo code MUSES when you subscribe.
For 40% off all subscriptions, visit mylola.com and enter the promo code MUSES when you subscribe. MYLOLA.com, promo code MUSES, MUSES. We have interviewed someone who was a dancer, and she did describe that experience as that, but I love your perspective and your take on it. And while, like, I'm so excited to get into, like, there's so many things I want to dive into here, so exciting. And, you know, I want to talk about things that you're presently working on and in the future, but I still want to talk about your book for a second. That's almost 10 years old now, and it's called The Last Living Slut. Do you think that if you would have published that book today, that it would have been received in any other kind of way? How was it received in 2010 when you were talking freely, openly, honestly about sexuality, masturbation, music, rock and roll, demonization of women?
So in the UK is very different to North America, the media. What I found that was when my book came out, my first book, I found that UK media was the only country who wouldn't interview me for the book, and they changed the cover and they were very reluctant to publicize the book.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was the only country, and the reason is that the UK has very rigid categories for diversity. It's like they say that if you are a Middle Eastern woman, you have to be a specific way. I find it a very cliche version of a Middle Eastern woman. And because I wasn't that cliche version, I was a woman, Middle Eastern woman, who wrote about sex and rock and roll, they felt uncomfortable publicizing my book at all, or me. And they were very scared to even put the original cover in the bookshelves. So I was discriminated against a lot, and when I couldn't get any jobs, like, I can't get any jobs here.
Oh, no. Okay.
So whenever I applied for journalism jobs, everything I did was American-based. So every time I applied for jobs here, they just would say no, no, no. And it's been 9 years now. It's only recently I found out from lots of sources in the media that they would Google me, and they don't like a woman who writes about politics, Islam, sex, and has sexy pictures, and they wouldn't take me on. And I think that's a kind of discrimination.
Totally.
And I just think, I love, in America, it's so different, because they love me, and they would offer me things, or I would get published there, even with my new book as an American publisher. So, I found a huge amount of discrimination because of no reason, because of what I wear or because of what I write. So, and that's only UK media and nowhere else.
That must be really frustrating for you.
It's horrible. It's like being a gay man in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you can't because of your sexuality. It's like, I haven't committed a crime, I haven't killed anyone, you know. It's like, you can't just discriminate because of what I wear or write. So, yeah, it's been really horrible and frustrating and kind of, you know, just not being able to get jobs. So, yeah, and a lot of things I did from other countries. So.
I mean, to hear that about the UK, like, I'm not shocked and I'm not surprised for some reason, but it's not right and it's super shitty.
It's called othering, which means they treat someone who's other than white differently. They walk around eggshells. Like, why wouldn't they publicize my book? Why? As a human story, why would they not interview me or want to have the original cover of me in the bookshelves? That's sort of saying, you're different, we don't want to talk about your human story.
That's really their loss. Do you think that that's going to change at all?
No, I don't. I think that with my second book, though, it will be the same. Because for them, Middle Eastern women should be a stereotype. Either the oppressed victim, like refugee, oh God, you know, I escaped Iran, you know, or the Muslim woman, or like someone who doesn't have sexy pictures, who's like an academic. You can't be both. You can't be a woman who has both, and both academic and teaching, and have sexy pictures. Why can't I be both? You know,
that's like a really good question.
You're not allowed as a woman to be both. Russell Brand is, he can talk about politics and talk about sex, but a woman can't. And In America, yes, I found it is. You can be, like, New York especially is, like, full of every type of person. But UK media, it's so backward. It's called othering. They like to, you know, the other has to be a specific category and stick to that category, you know. So, and I operate outside those frameworks. So they were like, no, no, well, you can't. You're not that category, you know.
Yeah, you really do. You can't really fit you into a category.
Yeah, I mean, it was met by so many different reactions. It's just, I think for me, like, I loved Motley Crue's book, The Dirt. Mm. And I was really like, I fucking love this band. They're so, like, crazy. And I was thinking, I have a similar life, but I'm a woman. And, you know, why shouldn't I write about it? They did. So in 2000, I had a fantastic reaction, like, from lots of people. For just being myself, you know, unvarnished, unglossy, just a human being. And then, I don't know. I mean, did I have anything bad reactions? Only from, I mean, if people haven't read it and they just see the word slut on the cover, they might be very narrow-minded about it. But people who read it, 99% was a really positive reaction. To me, the emails that I received, the thousands from all over the world, I'm not talking about the Western, I'm talking also about other parts of the world that you might not consider where women are kind of, there's a lot of oppression of women. For me, it was positive reaction. I think people who are logical and will read someone's human experience, they're not going to vilify that person for writing about their humanity. Mm-hmm. I've had loggerheads with other rock stars that I have sort of dated since, who have themselves written books with about graphic details of their sexuality, and they've said, oh God, Jade, we've got to keep our dating a secret because you wrote a book. And I'm like, yeah, but so did you. And they're like, yeah, but I'm a guy. I'm like, really?
That's
really
crazy. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
And these are guys that I would consider the most down-to-earth rock stars. You know, guys, I think you're one of the good ones. You're one of the nice ones, and they're kind of still so backward. It's like they're so living in the 1950s. It's really strange to me. One very legendary rock star I was seeing, and he was just so lovely as a guy and so sweet, and his mentality was very much like, you wrote a book, and I'm like, yes, and you did too, and he kept saying it's different, and I'm like, how? I don't understand. And I was really shocked and surprised, and I realized it applied to a lot of other rock stars, you know, like some of the guys in the Dead Daisies, some of the Motley Crue guys, you know, who've also written books. And it's just shocking to me at this day and age. It's like I'm living in a Muslim country. Their approaches towards women, it's really like, no, women have to have a specific designated role, but men have a different role. It's really funny and backwards.
It is so backwards. And Shanti and I were talking about this as well, how a lot of times when women write a memoir, just like the men who have written a memoir, for some reason, media or people in society sort of look at the women's memoirs like, oh, maybe they're after money or fame or something, as opposed to like
that's a bad thing.
Yeah. But I mean, as opposed to like just wanting to share your story, the female side of things, everyone who's been there is a historian in their own right. And why should the like rock star own that story more than, you know, the women who were also there? It takes two to tango. Like why should one kind of be able to own it more than the other?
Because it's still in 2019. Women and men are not equal, and that's the real truth of it. I mean, it's not, I'm not here going to whine about it. It's just a logical fact, you know. I mean, you look at someone like Russell Brand, you know, he's political, he's intelligent, he's a comedian. He's written two books on lots of sex. He's talked about graphic sex with Kate Moss, something about Courtney Love, something about this and that. Quite graphic stuff. And he's like a hero. He is an idol. He's idolized. And it's just normalized into our society. It's part of our society that male masculinity and sexuality naturally go together, but female and sexuality is problematic. And we have to get to the root of that. Why is it problematic if you're a human being, regardless of your gender? And this is a long, long-standing historical sort of mentality and approach towards women. I mean, I'm sure it's getting better, but it's because of so many aspects. I think it's getting better with the younger generation. You know, women, younger, like teenage girls and boys, do kind of say, well, I'm doing the same thing as a boy. It doesn't matter. I'm still a human being. But I think, especially in the world of rock and roll for me, I found this really backward mentality. Because we still got working with this outdated model of machismo and masculinity in rock and roll, where women are a secondary role to the men. Men are the primary role, central stage. Women have to be of service and subservient to a man. So for me, rock and roll has been extremely a misogynistic place, where it's like a playground, but only the boys are allowed to play the rules of rock and roll. Women have to be a bit more constricted and hold back from the same rules as the boys.
Yeah, you had mentioned that Motley Crue's The Dirt, like there's no female-fronted or girl bands that have ever been or have ever could get away with what they got away with. Like, is there any equivalent, any female rock star, any girl group that has, like, reached any kind of level of excess like that? What would that even look like?
Well, I mean, Madonna has talked about this a lot, and so has Courtney Love. Madonna said that when she was becoming famous, and she was quite sexual and dating, and she was constantly vilified about it in the press. And she was going, hold on a minute, but Prince is doing the same thing. Or like, you know, Mick Jagger is the same. I'm a musician. Why is Mick Jagger, like, there's different rules for him? Or Jimmy Page. So it's kind of like, no, I mean, in rock and roll, I think specifically in my experience, and I've been around rock stars and musicians since, I don't know, 2003, 2004. And it's just, you know, it's not deliberate or in a bad way. It's just deeply embedded, this ideology. You know, Courtney Love, you know, she gets a lot of crap, and, you know, it's Madonna did. And, yes, if there was a group like Motley Crue that was female and they wrote a book about their most graphic details of this, of their vaginas, and really extremely graphic, pornographic stuff, they would be hugely demonized. There wouldn't be a film being made about their life. There wouldn't be heroes like Motley Crue or like Tommy Lee is. Tommy Lee wrote a book about of his own about just his penis. Yeah, of his dick. Yeah, can you imagine like a woman writing about her pussy?
No, I can't. I'm trying to think if Peaches did it at all, but I don't know. Not like that. Last night I was out at a pretty trendy hipster karaoke bar, which is a Legion, and I saw somebody with a t-shirt. Do you see people there wearing t-shirts that say the future is female?
I haven't, no. I haven't.
Okay, so it's pretty, maybe it's a Toronto thing, but there's a lot of people that have the future is female shirt, and there was somebody last night, and they appeared to be, I don't know, like I'm just saying based on appearance, is perhaps non-binary, a gender fluid, and their t-shirt said the future is female ejaculate.
Wow.
It was great.
Human, let's just treat human beings by their character and not their sexuality, color, gender, anything, just their humanity and how they are as people. The end, you know.
Exactly. I think that well, hopefully we're seeing that a lot more in our sort of like younger generations not wanting to be you know, sort of boxed in, for lack of a better word. But there's some great, like, even children's books. One, for example, is called Neither. And essentially a book for five-year-olds about not feeling like a boy or a girl, feeling neither or feeling like both. And when you start early like that, I think it's a good thing.
And you know what? It's all great. And I don't want this to make me sound like, oh, all serious and politicizing rock and roll. I love rock and roll. I'm all for everyone being as rock and roll as they can, having fun, the amazing, a free-spirited world playground where, you know, it's free love, free sex, people just having fun, and the music and the beauty of it. But let's not make it only for boys. Let's make it for everybody, you know. Let's not demonize women for wanting to do what guys want to do. We're all the same in rock and roll. And that was, for me, the spirit of rock and roll has always represented something where you can just be yourself without judgment. But sadly, in my experience, it's not. Because, you see, a lot of people, and I think you do yourself, and I'm not trying to be saying anything bad about anyone, but like someone like Pamela DeBar, which I think she's a great lady, they're like, I want to be a groupie. Fine, be that. It's nothing wrong with wanting to be something, but don't think that your role is purely designated to kind of having to aspire to, you know, somehow serve someone because of their fame, because your power relations will never be equal when someone's that famous and you're there for them, to sort of be there for them because purely of their fame, then the power is very imbalanced. So it's kind of like, why should you be a secondary role? You know, when I've dated rock stars, I've always said to them, I've always thought, what can they do for me? It's not like, you should be balanced, not someone, me being a secondary role to somebody because of their fame. It's to do with their humanity. And fame is put in such a high esteem because of fame. You know, no, look, measure someone by how they are. You can be very easily starstruck, of course, and be like, oh my God, I'll do anything. But, you know, try and see that what is in it for you as well. Are you getting the same love and respect and sex? You know? That's all I've just been saying all along.
And now a quick break to tell you about modern fertility. In this day and age, people are waiting to have kids. By the time my mom was my age, 31, she had 3 kids already. That's right. 1, 2, 3 kids. We're out there building careers, being the bosses of our own lives.
And maybe we have a bit of a different timeline for having children. So understanding fertility levels and what makes sense and what's possible for us is very important. I wonder what it would look like if I wanted to have kids when I'm 35, let's say. So that's why I'm using Modern Fertility. Modern Fertility can empower you by giving you knowledge into your own fertility. Our hormones are kind of like detectives into our fertility, and that's where Modern Fertility comes in. So doctors and physicians will study your test results, and by taking the test, they'll let you know if you have more or fewer eggs than average, if you'll hit menopause sooner, if egg freezing or IVF is right for you. It's super easy. So you can go to modernfertility.com/muses, and you can order your test, which you can take at home or at a lab. It's the only comprehensive fertility hormone test that you can take at home in your jammies. Thank you very much. So they're there to provide help every step of the way, and there's a simple app that you can use. You can use it as a simple timeline so that you're aware of your options, because if there's something that we like, it's options. So that's modernfertility.com/muses, and you can get $20 off a purchase of your kit. You'll submit the test, certified physicians will review it, and then you can better learn to plan your fertility with accurate information. So, do I want to have kids? Maybe, maybe not. But I'm really looking forward to getting my test. I did the quiz online. It was actually super fun. It made me think a lot about my health and what I want moving forwards. And now I'm going to have this knowledge whether I want to have children in the next 2, 3, 5 years or not at all. Because like I said, options are our jam.
Speaking of, you know, the rock and roll side, you sort of started your backstage adventures in your mid-20s. Did you know what you were getting into? Were you a big music fan before that? We've talked about some of the negative aspects, like the misogyny that's still, you know, in that industry. And what are the positives? What were some of the things, like, what do you love about rock and roll? What do you love about dating musicians and, you know, that world?
So initially, I always, like, all the people I loved were dead.
I know the feeling.
The Doors, I always loved John Lennon, The Doors, and I love Jimi Hendrix, I love Janis. I'm just in the wrong era. I always listened to them when I was about, I'd say it. I loved Guns N' Roses too, but I kind of really liked the kind of romanticized version, if you like, of the 60s and 70s.
For sure.
And I was in love with Jim Morrison for as long as I can remember. Always loved John Lennon as well, and the Beatles. Not a massive fan of the Stones, I don't know why. But yeah, so, I mean, I kind of, of course I love the music. And then I guess I never thought I'm going to go and hang out with musicians at all. It was, I just listened to the music. But it just happened by accident, and I think it was just purely one night, accidentally, I had a friend who was, husband was the manager of the band The Stereophonics, quite a British band.
Yeah.
Very big in the 90s at the peak. And then I went to their house and I met the drummer, and he was one of the wildest and craziest guys I've ever met. He was free-spirited. He was creative. He was poetic. He was just funny and just this character. I'd never met anyone like such a character. I was just like sitting there looking and thinking, God, you're so cool and funny and sexy and just mad. And I started hanging out with him and I slept with him. And I thought, God, this guy's just like me, but a male version. And he's just so funny and cool to hang out with, and he's good in bed. And then I was like, and then after that, I started going to a couple of award shows, like for Kerrang! Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I met musicians, there'd be like these out of, like, big, larger-than-life characters, and I'd love their company. And it was fun. And then I went on tour with Velvet Revolver and met a few guys from Velvet Revolver. And I was just, like, fun at first. It was just fun hanging out with my friends and them. And then when I started actually falling in love and dating, that it was a bit jarring because I wasn't a teenager. I was in my late 20s. and early 30s. So I knew as a woman what was right and wrong. I wasn't starstruck in the same way as a teenager might. At least I was like, actually, I don't like this. I like you, but why are you being, you know... Just, I kind of found some of the things a bit jarring, a bit annoying, and it was just like, well, why can't I do this? And why am I... Like, it was just... I kind of didn't feel right. I still love rock and roll. I love music. But, like, you know... I guess when you are somebody who knows their sexuality, who knows, you know, equality, and you kind of start feeling a bit annoyed when sometimes you as a woman in rock and roll can't do what guys do. So, yeah. It's just annoying, and it's a bit, like, limiting. I want to let go and be free and be wild. I want to be rock and roll, but sometimes I can't. I'm not allowed to be.
Oh, I love that. I want to be rock and roll. And I love how, yeah, you're right. Like, it's an expression of something, and it's a feeling, and it's wild how, you know, over the generations and through the decades, and Lynx and I have just been exploring this a little bit lately about how, you know, every rock star is trying to almost, like, one-up its previous generation, and then it sort of took on a whole life of its own. And it's been even a while now since I've been to, like, local shows and done the backstage thing. Like, is there even a real backstage scene anymore, or did that just sort of burn out, and did that get stunted? You know, is rock and roll still as fun and free and wild as it ever as it has been, or is that over?
No, and there's three reasons for that. One is the internet. People talk on the internet. People have wives and girlfriends. The internet killed a lot of stuff. There is, with the advent of AIDS in the 80s, there wasn't that Led Zeppelin-esque free love, free sex, anything goes. Mm-hmm. And it was like people got sober and clean. Members of Guns N' Roses got sober and clean, and they are... how can I put this? Not as fun as you would imagine them to be. backstage, I've been backstage at Download Music thing since 2004, and every year it gets more like, oh, organic granola with your chamomile tea, and here's your iPad. So people, it's a very boring, office-y atmosphere. The only band who's still rock and roll and wild is Rammstein.
Yeah.
Those guys are insane. They out-party me. They out-sexualize me. And I'm like, you guys are in your 50s, man. Like, how? You know? There's no rules for them. They're just crazy Germans. Everything goes. They're like Motley Crue in the 80s. Rammstein.
Yeah, that's true. I'm thinking about this outdoor festival that I was at last summer or something, and yeah, the nice tents, the catering, everybody's on best behavior, plus everybody's watching, like everybody's really paying really close attention. Everybody's under a microscope, I think, especially with Me Too and Time's Up.
Yeah, of course, but they shouldn't be. It's just wrong and right. It's not right. Like, there shouldn't be blurred lines. It's just literally don't do that. No means no. The end. There's not like, I don't know what I did. It's just men should understand that it's just no means no. That's it. You know.
Speaking more on that, and something that's sort of happened with our podcast, where, you know, when we discuss these women and the artist, and we learn more about, you know, the background, that, you know, they're not these gods, they're humans. A lot of them have done things that, you know, are...
Like John Lennon, for example, how he treated Cynthia.
Yeah, you know, some of them have been violent with women. Some of them were dating 14-year-olds when they were 20-year-olds, right? How do you reconcile the art versus the artist? And, like, are you able to differentiate between the two? And, should we be doing that?
It's a good question, because it depends on the severity of what that artist has done. With Michael Jackson, I have a huge, paedophilia.
Yeah.
I can't. I just... I, I'm sorry, I just can't. If there's children and rape and...
Yeah.
It would pain me to support. I can understand, as an artist, he was talented and an amazing artist. I understand that. As a person, hurting children, I cannot. I can't say it's okay because he was a great artist.
Yeah.
I can't do that. With something like Jimmy Page and the teenage girls, it's, yes, they were underage, and it's kind of, to me, exploitation, because even if a girl says, yes, I love Led Zeppelin, guys, I'm willing to, it's my choice, yes, it's your choice, but you're not old enough to make that choice with your body yet. You haven't formed, this is not being patronizing to them, it's just, I know that when I was 14, I wouldn't have been able to make the decisions that I did after, when I was, like, in my 20s. It's a bit problematic. I totally understand because I love John Lennon. I also love Woody Allen. I love Roman Polanski.
Yeah.
There is a lot of films that Harvey Weinstein made that I love, that he produced. I really love them. It's a very difficult choice. You stop listening to that music. You stop watching those films. I don't know. It's a really difficult question. And I think every individual is going to be different. I think for me, if it's to do with harming children, then I would stop listening to that person's music.
Yeah.
It's paedophilia. It's just no. I don't care who you are. If, like, say, if Jim Morrison was found to be a paedophile, there's no way I would listen to The Doors again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm the same. Where I love Woody Allen, and that's been a difficult blow. And I feel like for me, it's like I'm never gonna financially support anything, you know, forward.
Sure.
You know, but yeah, it's a, I guess everyone sort of has to make their own moral judgment on what they're okay with.
Absolutely. And I think you have to remember that fame is an extremely powerful aphrodisiac. It's replaced religious zeal in terms of hero worship, you know, whereas in the past, people used to worship religious figures. When time moved on, and now it's famous people, celebrity is extremely powerful, especially if that person is very talented and they love the music, they love the film. So separating that is extremely tricky and extremely painful. It's like you're cutting off your family, it's cutting off somebody that you've grown to love, you know?
Yeah.
Individual. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you're working on right now. There's so many fantastic ways to go with this. So where would you like to start? We can talk about your journalism or maybe your upcoming book. What are you passionate about right now?
So I have a new book coming out, and it's called Dead Iranian Girl. And it's coming out this autumn, October or November. And that book is kind of like a follow-up to the first, similar, but not, it's kind of like a, it is a follow-up, but it's not in exactly the same vein as the first book. So, for example, because, you know, I'm on a blacklist in Iran, because I get imprisoned, so I paid some smugglers to take me there illegally on horseback.
You're so brave.
Yeah, I'm a bit stupid, too. I'm a bit stupid. I mean, I love Iran. I kind of wanted to experience the Middle East. So what I did, I went to Egypt, and I went to Jordan, and then I went to Turkey. So I paid smugglers to take me on horseback through the mountains to Iran. So the book isn't just about that. It has flashbacks to my life in the West. So you'll get a bit of, little bit of the rock legend that I was seeing. Not his name. I haven't named him. And you'll get a little bit of my life with a mafia boss in Vegas. It's a huge contrast. And I was interviewing the Ku Klux Klan in Alabama. And I do a bit of crazy stuff. So.
Yeah, so you also interviewed Richard Ramirez?
Yeah, so the serial killer, Richard Ramirez, he's dead now. But before he died, I was interviewing him about, he has a lot of groupies. A lot of women like him. They want to have sex with him. They wanted to marry.
That's an interesting element of the groupie dumb as well.
Hanson had it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Ted Bundy had it, and I guess a lot of serial killers. Like I said, fame is a very powerful aphrodisiac. And so I was writing to him about all these women, like, and what he thought about it. I mean, he was like, I have a whole stack of letters from him and his photos and his drawings of me, which is really weird. And I feel like I put them in a box and away from my house because I feel they're just negative energy.
Yeah.
It's so dark. But a fascinating insight into the human mind. So kind of the book is about East meets West. So Eastern, Middle Eastern journey. Cairo is a very ancient city. The buildings, the desert, the sand dunes. It's really, and in the contrast of like Vegas, with like the neon lights and a mafia guy and his like group, and then like a little bit about Man Ramstein, a little bit about the guy I was, the rock legend I was seeing. So it's just the contrast. And I always loved Hunter S. Thompson, who interviewed the Hell's Angels, and he did all this. And I liked how he just went on journeys and he just wrote about it.
Yeah, he's great.
I just wrote this journey. It's kind of a follow-up, I guess.
Sounds amazing. I'm so excited for it, and I just can't think of, like, anybody else more perfect to have that kind of story. It's just so unique. It's so you, and I think it's going to be fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I hope that it won't put off anyone who thinks I'm writing a whole rock and roll memoir again, because they'll go, oh, I wanted to know what else, you know, this and that and that, and I'll be like, sorry, there's not only that many names in there of rock stars this time, sorry.
No, just, a whole bunch of other fascinating stories, so we can, deal with a no-named rock star here.
Yes, absolutely, and I always been writing, like going to the Ku Klux Klan thing and stuff, and I always like to write about things that people might not talk about, so hopefully it's a good read.
You've also done some teaching and lecturing. Talk about sexual politics, gender theory. How do you find that experience? And, what kind of discussions do you want to continue to have?
Yeah, I've done, since my first book came out, I've done teaching and lecturing as well. And I've done a mixture of things. I've also done acting. I've been acting since I was, 6 years old.
That's right.
The teaching is great, and it's really fulfilling, and it's really great. I guess I'm the kind of person that I like to do lots of different things, and that's my downfall. That's my not to want to do all these different things. I've got to stick to one, and sometimes it's a bit tiring, and it's a bit too much.
I relate to that.
I love the teaching. I think it's great, but I'm quite a wild spirit, and I love rock. I'm a rock chick, and I don't see myself teaching full-time every day. I need to go and do other stuff, like performing or, different things. So far what I've done has been amazing, and I have really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed teaching. It's amazing.
Well, can we look forward to seeing you, acting? Are you doing, commercials, TV? Do you want to do movies?
Yeah, so I went to drama school when I was 21 for 3 years, and I started doing a lot of theatre then. And then when I started writing, I put my acting to the side. But recently, I did a small part in a BBC sitcom.
Oh, cool!
It's called Don't Forget the Driver, and it's like a comedy. And I also did a couple of small bits of theatre here and there. And I love acting. I also love writing. And yes, of course, I would hope to continue doing it. It would be great. So who knows what the future holds.
Amazing. Well, whatever it holds for you, it's going to be exciting, and we're looking forward to celebrating you more and seeing where you go, because you can do anything. Look at you.
I hope so. I'm quite a boring person, to be honest. My favorite thing is getting in my pajamas and watching TV, so I'm really not that interesting. I just like to do certain things that might seem interesting, but as a person, I'm a real homebody, trust me.
So is the rock and roll life sort of on hold right now? Do you still go to shows? What Are there bands, newer bands out there that you're really into?
You know, I do go to shows. You know, I feel sad that in this world, new and upcoming bands aren't given the exposure and the publicity and the money to do what in the past they were given. They're not encouraged and supported by the industry. You know, R&B or your Kanye West or American Idol, you know, whatever. They're so commercialized, and the spirit of rock and roll is like they're trying to, you know, extinguish it. So there is, when there's up and coming bands I see, and they're amazing, I think I wish they'd be given more support by the industry, you know. I haven't really seen kind of anyone that I've thought there's a new great band. I still go to shows and I see like old bands and stuff, and it's still, people still love rock and roll. Like you said, there isn't that kind of backstage debauchery thing at all. But yeah, of course I love the music. I will continue going to see bands for the music. And it's still there, thankfully.
Yeah. Have you seen a trailer for the Dirt movie? Do you think it's going to be good? Do you think it's going to suck? What do you think?
I saw a little bit, like a clip of the trailer. I think it's a very strange film to make, because if you're going to be true to the book, I've read the books millions of times, and it's written by my editor, Neil Strauss, who wrote Marilyn Manson's book as well.
Oh.
And he also wrote a few biographies of them. If you're going to be like the book, you can't make that into a film. It is beyond pornographic. I mean, it is like exploitation to its fullest. I don't know if you've read the book, but the things they made...
Oh, yeah.
Either they're going to whitewash that and Disney-fy it and make it a kind of family PG-friendly version of them.
Like they did with Bohemian Rhapsody?
Exactly. Because, obviously, Freddie Mercury was just insanely debaucherous, and they made it like a Disney version of Freddie, you know. So either they're going to do that and make it family-friendly to that, which will be a shame, because Motley Crue were insane. They think they did with Ozzy, like... snorting ants and peeing and drinking each other's pee and putting their penises in burritos and stuff. I love that book. It'd be such a shame if they, like, I'm sure they will in this age, Me Too and everything. Are they going to show all that, what they did to women? I don't think so. So I'm sure what we will be seeing will be a kind of cleaner version of them. It's a bit of a shame, but... What can you do? They want to make money out of films. They're not going to make it that debauched, are they?
True. Yeah, so true. Is there anything that we haven't touched on or that we've missed that you would like to speak about? We just want to make sure that we've got everything in here and our...
No, like, obviously I talked about my new book and everything. I just thought I would really like to see a round table or kind of like somebody to start some sort of event that happens in different countries like Canada, UK, America, maybe Germany and stuff, of rock and roll women. You know, whether you follow rock and roll or you are a musician or you're a groupie or anything, to get together maybe annually and just get together, share stories and like talk about things, have speakers. It'd be a great event to keep the spirit of rock and roll alive.
That would be so incredible. I love that idea.
Be amazing. Yeah.
I love it. And if that ever happens, then we'll see you there.
Well, you got the contacts.
Certainly
get to work on.
Yeah, we're certainly getting there. There's, I think, lots of exciting things coming for us and for you. So definitely... keep in touch and just keep sending each other this really great, abundant energy.
Sure, and I hope to see you in Toronto because I might be doing a book signing there.
Yes.
Oh, that'd be so much fun, yes. We can talk more about the book, too.
Absolutely, yes. I hope to come there and do a signing, and yeah, it'd be great.
Well, anything that you need, let us know, and we'll help in any way possible.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much. This was everything that I hoped that it would be. I really do admire you, and it was really lovely meeting you that one time. And, yeah, I think you're great. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for a great interview.
Oh, thanks, Roxana. I'm so excited to speak again.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much. And here's to meeting each other in person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there you have it, an interview with the amazing Roxana Shirazi. If you want to read more of her stuff and anything from her research papers to her articles, her poetry, then you can go to roxanashirazi.co.uk. And if you want to find her on Instagram, then just head over to Roxana Shirazi Official and make sure to get her book, read it, The Last Living Slut. And don't forget to look out for that new book, Dead Iranian Girl, coming out in the fall. Take care, and we'll see you next time.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's Hypothetical.